Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's still recuperating, so we have Sean McNally interviewing with me, and it's been wonderful, and I'm so glad. And today we have Johnny A.
Sounds good. Sean? Absolutely. Johnny, thanks for joining us, buddy. We appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely.
Sure, Sean. How are you? Good. I'm good, buddy. Thank you. So we were, as Dinky said, this is about the channel, essentially, but we also talk about, you know, the Boston music scene at that time frame, and the time frame we're talking about is mostly the 80s. I know you were around before that, though. You get your start in the 70s with the live music, but we will get to the channel quite a bit, of course, but I do want to kind of step back, and maybe you can just give us a little bit of an overview. I know you're a local guy. You were born in Malden, but maybe kind of take it from your first introduction to music, your first instrument you played, that kind of thing. It's like your early years, so to speak.
Yep.
Okay, well, now you're really taxing my memory, but let's go. Let me see. I started as a, you know, going into music and wanting to play music when I was about 6 years old. And I started as a drummer.
Wow.
And played for about 5 or 6 years and actually took drum lessons from the great jazz drummer, Alan Dawson.
Oh, wow.
He actually went to school with my dad, and they were on the track team together, how I ended up taking lessons from Alan. But then a strange thing happened on February 9th, 1964. I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, which completely sidetracked or changed my my path, I should say, from wanting to be a drummer to wanting to play guitar and just explore and expand my musical ability into kind of the melodic realm, because as you know, drums are really just a percussion instrument. And I just had a lot of melody always in my head, and I wanted to get that out. So, you know, I got influenced by a lot of the British Invasion bands, Beatles, Yardbirds, Stones, Animals, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really was my earliest stuff. So I started playing guitar, I think probably I might have been 11 or 12.
Wow.
The first band I played guitar in, I believe I was 12 years old.
That's great.
And you mentioned that you talk about icons. I mean, you mentioned some of your influences from the very beginning. I know the Beatles, of course, and we'll get into later on some of your guitar heroes that, you know, ironically enough, you ended up playing in their band, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But I know also your influence when you saw Jimi Hendrix a couple of years after the Beatles played Boston, right?
I did. Well, I saw the Beatles in 66. At Suffolk Downs.
Yep.
And then 2 years later, I saw Jimi Hendrix Experience, the original Jimi Hendrix Experience, in August of 68 in Framingham at the Carousel Theater.
That's right.
And then then to bump up a little bit beyond that, then your first band was in the 70s, right? Tell me how you became familiar with the whole Kenmore Square Boston rock and roll epicenter, so to speak.
Well, I had been playing in bands, like I said, since I was probably 12 years old, and did all the high school dances and the CYO clubs and teen centers and things like that all around Malden and Saugus, where I graduated, Saugus High School. And then my mom owned a couple gas stations in Kenmore Square. There were two Texaco stations in Kenmore Square, and my family owned those. So, you know, as a kid, all my friends, we were all into music and all had bands in the local, you know, in our towns. And we would go in on Saturdays and take the nickel tour of all the music stores, E. Wurlitzer's when it was on Hereford Street, and
yep,
Jack's Drum Shop and all these places. But again, in 1970, I graduated and I was working at those gas stations in the graveyard shift. So I was very familiar with the scene of Katie's and Lucifer's and the Rat and all these places. And I just started to, you know, try to put bands together and kind of was a fixture on the scene for a long time. My first band really started playing the Rat probably, I think, around 74. That's when it started for me.
Wow.
And that, so in the, to get into Kenmore, I know you're obviously working down there. Did that kind of also help influence where you decided to go to college, or was that just kind of an afterthought?
Well, I didn't really want to go to college, to be honest with you. I was never really a good student, and I tried my luck at college twice. First time was, I believe, I went for half a semester to Berkeley, but I was miserable there, and I didn't do well there. And then I did, I think, maybe 1 year at Graham Junior College, which is, you know, where I met. Funny, because my two oldest musical Boston friends I met in the same year, one when I was going to Berkeley, and that was Elliot Easton from the Cars, and the other one was John Butcher when I was going to Graham Junior College. We were in the same class together.
Wow.
So that's kind of my original meeting with some of these guys. And I worked at the local music store in Boston. I worked at E. Wurlitz's. So okay. I was a counter guy. You know, I was one of the box clerks and, you know, was one of the salesmen. So I would see everybody come in, and I would meet all the bands that would come in, whether it was the New York Dolls or George Benson or, you know, anybody that came through town, you know, James Brown, Aretha Franklin. So I was like kind of immersed in the whole Boston scene even before I had a band that was actually playing the Boston scene, because I had been hanging around, like I said, Kenmore Square and the music store, E. Wurlitz's, which was the biggest music store in Massachusetts anyway, since 1971.
Yep.
Right. Talk about a three-headed marsh of amazing guitar players right off the bat, huh? You and John and Elliot, my goodness. You didn't really start with a much threesome of lead guitar players, and looking back that far. Pretty amazing.
What, one,
and then,
one question from me.
Ahead,
one quick question in this time period for me. Did you ever see Oasis with Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green?
No, I unfortunately, I never did. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like I didn't get really that much into Peter Green till much later, till much later when he was out of Mac, you know. You know, I think it, for some reason they were never really on my radar early on.
I get you.
It was much later. But, you know, he was a pretty phenomenal guy. And from what I understand, you know, as much as I was into the early Clapton stuff with Cream, from what I understand, it was Peter Green was the guy back then. But
that was for sure.
You know, Clapton seemed to be the one that resonated with most people.
That was for sure. I can't say how much it was to me, because I saw where I started with stuff.
I know that. Yeah,
he's 68.
I remember that. Yeah,
and I love every minute of it. It was the just standing there, side of the stage before I started mixing, and watching Peter play and watching the feel of everything, that turned me on to guitarists. And ever since then, I've had different genres of guitarists. Clarence White from the Byrds with the Bender and what have you, and then move on with John McLaughlin and Jeff Beck. And it's just, the guitarists seem to want to follow me. It's tough that I'm saying. Then when I come to the channel, I see this group, it's called Johnny A and the Hidden Secret. I was like, okay, this guy's got something going here and stuff. And I admired you from the get-go. And then when you started with all the other stuff, I'll get back to Sean's questions now, but I just wanted to really ask if you did hear Peter. And
lately I've been digging into some old bootleg live stuff that wasn't readily available back then, so I've really garnered an appreciation for him later in life rather than you know, in the moment when he was
there,
you know, really present. I wasn't aware of him as much back then.
Yeah, but Boston was our little hometown. Every time we came through, we'd rather be in Boston than anywhere else. In fact, we came back 2 weeks after one show and did another one, and it was just the energy, the scene at that time in the late 60s, early 70s. And I said, I'm going to stick to it. So I started building through EOL and BG and all that crowd in there, and Billy Murray and, you know, all of them.
Yeah, well, that whole scene, which was kind of like, I wouldn't say a full generation before the scene that we're talking about that I was in. I mean, those were bands like The Bagatelle, The Lost, Spinach, Ill Wind, Beacon Street Union, Caldwell Winfield Blues Band, Billy Caldwell. And, so I was kind of hip to all that stuff, but that was that whole 1968 to 72 period.
Yeah, that's
whereas when my band, when my band The Streets and my contemporaries were kind of breaking through, it was like started maybe late 74 for me. And then like The Streets went from 75 to maybe the very beginning of 1980 or the tail end of 79. And that's when the Hidden Secrets band came together. Then after that, Hearts on Fire.
Yeah.
And
you on your own.
And then I kind of like was getting disillusioned with the fact that I saw all my friends get record deals. Every one of my contemporaries, Charlie Farron, Steve Cataldo, the Atlantics, the Nervous Eaters, the Stompers, John Butcher, all of my contemporaries got record deals except for me, and we had a good following. I used to get tons of airplay, but, for some reason it kind of passed me by. And I was, at that point, I was really getting disillusioned with having my own band and being a band leader. And that's when I started to do kind of the sideman thing. And I hooked up with, initially was Doug Clifford from Creedence Clearwater. And then I gravitated and worked for 2 years with Bobby Whitlock. As his musical director and guitarist. And I put the band together for him. And once once the Whitlock thing dissolved, it kind of dovetailed me into the Peter Wolf thing, which I did for about 7 or 8 years as his MD and stuff. And then after Peter dissolved that band, it brought me back into wanting to do my own career again. And, I was thinking about it today and speaking to somebody about it today is that all my friends, like we were just talking about my contemporaries, they all seem to get their break earlier on, like maybe 25 years old, 24 years old. And it really wasn't until I was 40 that I actually, or maybe I might have even been a little bit older because it was probably the year 2000. I was born in 52. That's when I got my first major international record deal. And that's when my kind of popularity and commercial success started to happen. Then I put my own album out, and that initially my first album in 99, and it got picked up by Sony Records, Sony Red, and Steve I's label, Favored Nations, in 2000, and he released it internationally in 2001, and that's kind of where my career started to blossom, actually. So it was very, very late for me.
Wow, that's
amazing. Yeah. So we jumped ahead of a lot of stuff during that. It's a great background. I don't want to just escape or miss some of these those points. I'm going to take it back a little bit during that, Johnny. Again, your first band was The Streets. You didn't form that band, though, correct? You were hired gun for that.
No, that was my band. I formed that band.
Okay,
that was my first Boston-based band, but. I had bands in high school and I also lived in Portland, Maine for a while where I had a band up there. But my first band in what we're talking about, this Boston music scene from that time period, was The Streets. And I put that band together. That was my band.
And that was right after high school, essentially, right? And then you guys started digging.
It was about 5 years after high school. I mean, I graduated in 70 and I was still playing around locally. And then, like I said, I did maybe a semester at Berkeley, maybe a semester or a half a year at Graham. Mm-hmm. I was working at the music store. I went out to the Midwest and played in the band out in the Chicago area for a while. And then I came back and I was in a band in Portland, Maine. And then while I was in that band in Portland, Maine, I flew to London and I auditioned for Bill Bruford from King Crimson.
Ah, wow.
And when I came back from that audition, I didn't get the audition. Ray Gomez got the gig. But when I came back, I had this, and I was doing kind of a prog rock thing. It was like a progressive rock music kind of. I was into Fripp. I was into John McLaughlin. I was into Yes. I was into Gentle Giant. I was into a lot of that stuff. But when I came back from London, I kind of got disillusioned, and I decided to, I wanted to move back to Boston and put together kind of a heavy rock band that had a lot of melodic content. So it almost ended up being like really what Cheap Trick ended up being in 78. I was trying to do that in 75, where I had nice melodies, but it was a harder edged band.
Right. And you got quite a bit at that point. You did get a lot of airplay on BCN, correctly. It goes back to the point of how important WBCN was, another common theme for these. BCN was a gigantic engine, so to speak, to get local musicians and their music to like a very, 50,000 watt station. You could hear them all over New England for the most part, and that was a big, big help to bands like yours.
Yeah, you can't really underscore the importance of WBCN in the Boston music scene, not just for myself, but for everybody, every struggling guy that was trying to, or gal that was trying to break through and get a deal. I mean, them, Oedipus, actually, at my first airplay was over at MIT with Oedipus and Carter Allen. And then when they moved over to BCN, I was getting airplay on BCN. And at the time, there was a COZ, WCOZ. And so I got a ton of local airplay. I got as much airplay as bands with labels in that time. But just for whatever reason, it didn't, it just didn't click. We got courted by, I got courted by a lot of people like Aerosmith's manager, David Krebs, came to see me numerous times. And, but it just didn't think, he just didn't think we had the right front man. I don't disagree with him. So,
at the time frame, even though it didn't quite, you didn't get your break so early, so to speak, you were, recognized. Well, you're getting a lot of airplay for sure. You guys were in the first BCN Rock and Roll Rumble, which is the Rat Pack. That was 1979. Mm-hmm. And I know you were also supporting the likes of Aerosmith, even Bob Seger back then. So your name was out there, at least to a degree, and getting a lot of respect by some people.
By some.
Yeah, I mean, it was. We were doing a lot. Like I said, we worked with Seger. We worked with Joan Jett. We worked with Aerosmith, worked with Derringer, David Johansen, Smithereens. I got a lot of good work, and a lot of visibility gigs as a support act. But like I said, I wasn't fortunate enough. And, things happen for a reason. So I don't really necessarily have any bitterness about that, because I think that by the time I actually did get a shot and I was able to put out my first album. And, I think I grew exponentially as a musician and a composer and just the way my craft is, I think it was fine, and it worked out for me because I'm still here doing it at the same level. I've been doing this now under my own moniker as a solo artist now for 30 years. Close to 30 anyway. 1999 is when I released my first, completely solo album under my name.
Sure, sure. And then again, not that this was, you weren't doing much around town. You had the streets was a good thing going. Then you went to your second band, your first band to play the channel was the Johnny A's Hidden Secret, like Nicky mentioned earlier. And that band, again, more BCN airplay. You guys in the 86 Rumble. Well, that was later on. I think Hearts on Fire. Because the Johnny A's Hidden Secret became the first that you played the channel, and then after that was Hearts on Fire.
Hidden Secret did do one of the Rumbles. I just don't remember what year it was.
Okay.
It might have been 83 or 82 or something like that. When we did it at Metro, I remember we were we might have been in the semifinals or something like that. Or I can't remember. But so we did that. And then again, Hearts on Fire, like you were saying, I think that was 86.
Yes. Yeah. And that was runner-up to the Gangrene, which is an infamous show with the Orpheum. But back then, the Rumble was always a big deal. It still goes on today to a smaller degree. But, playing the Metro, packed houses, they had the finals of the Orpheum back then. It was really, again, it just gets back to the point of how important WBCN was and what kind of juice they had. So when they were behind a local band, like you were saying, Johnny, back then, you didn't have to have any record deal. They would play you. You would get on the radio, and like you mentioned before, bands like Axis and you guys and Atlantics and all these local bands, Eaters, all getting airplay with like national, next to Springsteen and next to The Who and, bands that were worldwide known. And you guys are getting airplay, which was, incredibly important. And what a great time to be alive, right, for that scene.
Yeah, we were lucky. I mean, the Boston music scene really at that time was as hot as any scene has ever been. You know, yeah. Whether it's in New York or Nashville or L.A. or San Francisco, you know, it was, you know, as hot as anything at, in that period from, I would say, you know, I mean, that Bosstown sound, what they called it, the, you know, with MGM Records and Ultimate Spinach and Beacon Street Union and those, you know, that was kind of like a weird thing that didn't quite explode. But that next wave that was around the 1977 period, yeah, that was pretty exciting to be in Boston. And, you know, Boston is a unique music city,
yep,
in the respect that if you think about Boston, it has, and it still does, but especially back in the day, it had unbelievable blues scene. Mm-hmm. You had a fantastic jazz scene because you had Berkeley and, right, you had Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop. And then you had a great singer-songwriter vibe because you had Van Morrison here, you had James Taylor, all the Taylors, and you had a rock scene. You know, you had Aerosmith, you had the Jay Giles Band. It was like a very unique kind of little musical mecca that a lot of other cities didn't have. You know, you go to Nashville, it had a fantastic country scene. You know, right, you go to L.A., it had a great rock scene. You know, Chicago, yeah, had a great blues scene. But Boston had a whole plethora of different musicalities in a scene. And right, it seemed to coexist well together.
Yeah, 100%. And that's been one of the common themes, you know, that Boston was really – you could put up against any scene in the world, honestly, at that point. What was going on here between – the talent, having Berkeley in the backyard, have all the college kids here, and there was clubs. There were so many clubs to play back then, and you could play every night of the week, and literally, it was not going to hurt your draw on like a big weekend show because people went out. The drinking age was 18 back then.
Yeah, 18 year old drinking age, and as soon as that changed to 21, you immediately saw attendance drop. Yeah. I mean, we used to play. The streets would play four sold-out shows in a row. You'd play Thursday through Sunday at the Rat, wow, you know, and you headline every night. You know, and you'd still walk out with no money.
The Rat days are fun for sure. But no, just to get back to the point, though, what an amazing time to be alive it was then. And to that point, the channel is our main focus on the
exactly,
podcast. Yeah, so the Hidden Secret, your first real act that played the channel, because the channel opened in 1981. The first show I could find you was in August of 81, John Butcher Axis, again, a friend forever. They were the headlining act. American Teen was in the bill, and then Johnny Ace Hidden Secret was the third band of the three that night. And then you came back again 4 months later with for John Butcher Axis, this time as direct support. That's again in 81. Then you had the Fools direct support. You had some really good slots at that point. And your first headlining gig I found was in 82, early 82. So really within 6 months of getting your first exposure at the channel, you were headliners there. And that was March of 82, early on. Pretty impressive.
And then you also had Benefit, the channel at that time, period, May 19th, September 3rd, John Butcher Axis, JAA, yes, and another band before you. And then you opened for the Stompers on November 12th. And after that, 83, you were headlining, except you did open in March of 83 with Dickie Betts and all that and stuff. And then the Stompers, record release party, and then the Benefit for Oxfam, and then Gary Shane and the Detours, then you. And then you were headlining again, and then Stompers and Johnny, and then it changed everything because it wasn't Hidden Secret anymore. It was Johnny A, New Career, was another band after you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You guys, I think Sean told me earlier that I had played the channel 33 times. If you asked me, Cole, how many times have you played the channel? I would have said probably six or seven. I can't believe that I played it that many times.
You weren't that way.
Amazing.
You weren't. You weren't that wasted.
But, no, I was always a pretty clean and sober guy.
And then later on, you brought this young lady on stage, and she played with Hearts on Fire, and she became your wife.
Oh yeah, my wife Beth. We'd be married. As a matter of fact, in June we'll be married 44 or 45 years.
Congratulations! Wow. And you have a graduation young lady. I hear. Is that right?
We got a son, we got a daughter, and I just had my first grandchild.
Congratulations, kiddo. That's what
She just turned a year old.
Our grandchild is 17.
Yet? Oh, yeah. No, but I'll tell you, man, whenever I put my guitar on, she wants to play it.
I love it.
That's so cool.
That's so real cool.
So, like at that time, Dickie's mentioned, like late 83, you kind of were shutting down the Hidden Secret. You did a few shows as, you know, main support as Johnny A. And then Hearts on Fire became, you know, probably one of the better bands you're known for in the Boston scene, at least. And I have the first time you guys played there in March of 85 as main support to Robin Lee and the Chartbusters.
Yep.
Another great to open your channel engagement, so to speak. And then a few months later, the Schemers, you guys are direct support again. The Fools, direct support again. And we found you played there 15 times as Hidden Secret, and then 15 times as well, Hearts on Fire, which is pretty crazy. So that's a long run.
I played there once when I was with Bobby Whitlock.
Yep.
I think I played there once when I was with Peter Wolf.
I think you did play there once after you went solo. Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, I played there twice after the bands. Once was with Bobby Whitlock, and once was with Peter Wolf. I was just talking to Joe Bonamassa about that, because that was the first time I met Joe when Bloodline, his band Bloodline, opened up for Peter Wolf at the channel.
Wow.
Joe was 15 years old then. That's when I first met him.
Young. Yes.
Yeah, he played later on, too. He played later on in the channel. Mm-hmm. I've lost my thought now because that was a good one.
Let's talk about, you played every year, Johnny, from 81 through 89 in at least one incarnation of your musical project. So any of those gigs that like really stand out as a memory you will never forget, whether it's either during your set or in the crowd or anything like that comes to mind right away when I say, hey, the channel and Johnny A, is there any one thing that really pops to your mind?
You know what else? I think I also played there once as a member of the Nervous Eaters. because I was for a very short time I played in the Eaters, and for a very short time I played in the Stompers too.
Oh, that's funny! I 40 gigs there then. We missed a couple.
What stands out? I remember the night with Bobby Whitlock was a really good night. And it always was a good gig when you played on the bandstand with Peter, you know, Wolf. I have a hard time remembering my own gigs, to be honest with you. I don't know if any one really stands out. I remember doing one with Face to Face.
Yeah, that was a New Year's.
Maybe. Yeah, I can't remember, to be honest with you. I'm sorry.
No, that's all good. I mean, yeah, there's the last time I think you guys played there was actually New Year's Eve 89 with Fahrenheit. You had a few gigs main support for Fahrenheit, and that was the last time I think you played the club, which was a couple years before it ended up shutting down. But, Fahrenheit, Hearts on Fire, Shoot the Thread, and DJ Todd Modena. It was New Year's Eve 1989.
89, wow.
Yeah, so it's been a little while. But
someone's done their homework.
This is a database at Dickie Bell, which is pretty amazing for the listeners. Again, it's Boston's Best Live Rock.com. You can see every show, every date from the channel's opening in 1980 to finally close in 91, 92. What a database. Yeah, there's no way I could have told you off the top of my head all this stuff. We did some digging on this to find all your shows, but there's quite a few, to say the least.
Oh, yeah.
I just mentioned offline real quick. This is kind of funny. I remember one show in particular with you guys. It was July 1st of 89. I had just graduated Northeastern, and I had a combined 4th of July / graduation party where I grew up out in Clinton, and all the channel staff came and a bunch of my friends. And that was that night we all made sure we hustled back to Boston because it was you guys are playing with the Romantics. And I remember that was the night of running back and forth to get to Boston in time for the show. That was a fun night, to say the least. Long night, but fun night. And then, like you say, after that, you kind of became a, I don't want to say a gun for hire, but you really had crafted your, or, you know, tuned in your craft. You were, you know, the Peter Wolf thing came up, and that was a pretty major part. I think it was 6 or 7 years where you were his MD as well as in his band, obviously.
Yeah, and, you know, that, like I said, that dovetailed right after the Bobby Whitlock thing that I did with him. And the Peter thing really blossomed into a lot longer tenure than we all thought it was going to be. Like I said, it was 7 or 8 years. And you know, it was really the kind of the education that I got working with Peter that prepared me for my first album, because up until that point, being a band leader and going into the recording studios, you know, bands would, I didn't ever do a full album before. I was always doing 4-song demos or 2-song demos. And so being asked to be responsible for producing an artist or co-producing an artist's full album's worth of material, you know, being responsible for, you know, being the music director and keeping things in line for over the course of however many months it takes to make an album and 13, 14, 15 songs, that really prepared me for what happened right after the Peter Wolf thing in 1999 when I did my first solo album. So it really, like, honed my skills into being able to just compile all the goods that I needed to be able to record 12, 15 songs on my own and keep it going, you know. So that was pretty invaluable. You know, I learned a lot of great musical and music business lessons working with Peter. So,
of course, you got to tour the world.
That was a great time for me. Yeah,
that's cool.
No question. And I do want to get into the you know, focus on your own stuff as far as, like you said, your solo career pretty much launched in 99 with your first record, and that was licensed by Steve Vai's company called Favorite Nation Entertainment, and that led to an instrumental number one single, which is very rare. What do you talk about that, if you don't mind?
Yeah, well, how that happened was I was playing this residency at this place called the Dodge Street Grill in Salem, Massachusetts, where I was living at the time. And I was doing a Tuesday night residency there. And this guy, Lefty, his name, they called him, and he worked for Polygram Records at one point. He lived in Salem as well. And he came in the club and he fell in love with what I was doing. And he brought this guy in that had a local label, but he had national distribution. And he wanted to sign me. And, you know, I said, well, yeah, I just have one condition, that I get to make the record that I want to make and that I have 100% creative control on it, which he gave me. And but the problem is, we went into Blue Jay Studios. I started recording the record, and halfway through the record, the guy ran out of money. So I ended up taking out a loan. I bought the tapes from him. And I ended up finishing the record on my own dime, and I put it out, and I started to get airplay on, like, the river, and it just started to spread all over New England. It went from the river, it went to Lewiston, Maine, it went to Lake Placid, New York, it went down to Northampton, down into Connecticut. It just started to get massive airplay. This song, it was called Oh Yeah, and I ended up selling close to 9,000 CDs on my own. And I was consigning to all kinds of record stores all over New England. As a matter of fact, I have to also thank Mike Dries from Newbury Comics, because Lefty brought me into Mike Dries and told him that, hey, Johnny's song is reacting on the radio, but there's no outlet for anybody to buy it. So he ended up giving me a listening post spot on all 21 of his stores.
Wow, that's great.
Which is, like, record labels paid a lot of money.
That's great.
And he just donated it to me. He gifted that to
me.
Wow. And between Lefty, The River, and Mike Dries at Newbury Comics, it was just unstoppable. And I ended up being the biggest selling artist, independent artist. You know, not like the U2s or the Springsteens, but independent artists in at the time at Newbury Comics. So I was selling, you know, I don't know, 800 records a week. It was crazy.
That's great.
So how it ended up with the Steve Vai thing is labels started to call me once they saw that I was getting all this airplay. And how I picked the single was really strange. And this goes back, I have to thank Peter Wolf for this, because when I was on the road with Peter, we did South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And we went into the radio station to do an interview. And when Peter did the interviews at the radio stations, he always brought me with him with an acoustic guitar. So he could give the interview and he could sing a song and I would play guitar and he'd play harmonica and blah, blah, blah. So I would meet all these program directors. And there was this one guy in Austin, Texas at KGSR Radio called Jody Denberg. And he was a great guy and he was considered really a tastemaker for the AAA radio format, AAA album, adult album alternative or something like that. I think that's what it stood for. And those with stations like KGSR in Austin and KFOG in San Francisco and KBCO in Boulder, Colorado, and the River in Boston. That was those type of stations. So before the River even started playing my song, I sent the album, my first album, down to Jody Denberg in Austin, Texas. And I asked him, I said, you know, I'm not asking you to play it. I'm asking you to just, if you could give it a spin and listen to the record, tell me if any song pops out at you. And I followed up with him like about 3 or 4 weeks later. And he said, hey, man, how you doing? I actually played your song and I got some radio reaction on it. And I said, really? He said, yeah, I got a lot of calls on it. I said, well, what song was it? He said, I don't know the name of it. It was the second song in the album, which ended up being Oh Yeah, which was not the song I would have picked for the single. So I said, well, this guy's a pro, and he's known for his ears in the industry. So that's when I started pushing that song to the River, and I wasn't getting nowhere with them. They weren't playing it. I wasn't getting any response. And then one day, I guess someone requested me on a Freeform lunch, and the song blew up, and they called me, and they just said, we got so many phone calls on this. Can you come in and play in the studio? Oh, wow. So I went in the studio, and it was actually the week before I did my first headlining show at the House of Blues, the original one, in Cambridge.
Cambridge.
And so we went on the air. We did the show. We played live. We promoted the show, and the House of Blues sold out. I ended up getting a residency from, you know, Tony. Remember Tony that used to do the booking there?
Yeah.
I did, you know, ended up with a residency. One thing leads to another. Thing's taken off. I'm starting to get labels calling me, RCA, Epic, Blue Note, all these other people. And I did some showcases. And then one day, I didn't get a deal. I never got an offer for a deal. So I was going to mortgage my house and try to do a national campaign for the record. I figured, okay, well, if it's reacting in Boston and it's reacting in Texas and it's reacting in Vermont, it'll react everywhere. That was my way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a call from Sean Coakley. He had a company called Songlines, which was a radio promotion company. And he discouraged me from doing a national campaign on my own. He says, he said, you know, I think you're naive to think that you can go up against the U2 and the Rolling Stones and the blah, blah, blah. And so he said, let me send this record to somebody. So he sent it to a person. His name is Howie Gabriel. And Howie Gabriel was the president, and he ran Sony Red Distribution. Sony Records, Red Distribution. They had a bunch of boutique labels under him. One of them was Favored Nation, Steve Vai's label. He sent it to Steve. Steve called me up and was raving about the album. And he asked me if he could put it out on his label. So we came out with a licensing deal. He licensed that first record. Like I said, it went on to sell, I don't know, I think to date it's probably around 200,000 copies.
That's great.
And then he offered me an artist record deal for a three album deal, I believe it was. And the next record, which came out in 2004, which is called Get Inside, had a song that was nominated for a Grammy on it. And after that, there was some regime change within the company, and it just didn't seem to be right. I mean, the first record was doing so good that actually got upstream to Danny Goldberg at Artemis Records. But then I signed the record deal with Steve for three more albums. I did one, and then I got myself off the label. And it took me 6 or 7 years to put out another product because on my record contract with Steve, I had a no re-record clause for 7 years. So I couldn't really record. I wanted to do a live album, which I did do at Scullers. And but I couldn't do it for, I couldn't release it for 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
So that came out. It was a live DVD CD. And then my last record, my last full length record was in 2014, the Driven album.
Oh.
So the end of the whole Steve Vai era, Artemis Records with Danny Goldberg, that was, like you say, you had to wait a few years. And 2010 is the DVD live, when you're talking about the DVD CD set at Scullers. And that was, so that's 2010. Also the year you won the Boston Music Awards Blues Artist of the Year. So your name was still for sure out there, right, in the local scene, no question. And it also led to all the airplay one time. You get in front of the kind of people you were in front of. You got your own guitar. You were endorsed by Gibson fairly early on, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, I was an endorsed artist by Gibson while it was Peter Wolf, starting in 94 or 95, I believe. But when the first album started to get legs, and I started to get a lot of media coverage, both radio and, you know, I had a music book with Warner Brothers. You know, I had an instructional DVD. And then, you know, like I said, the radio airplay and the magazines and all that other stuff. Gibson approached me about wanting to do a signature model, which we did do. And it was in the line for 18 years.
No.
And it was their second best-selling model in the Gibson Custom Shop. The only one above me was Les Paul. second place. So it's not bad company to be in.
No,
it's, wow.
That was excellent. That was excellent. I like that a lot.
You know, then the Driven album came out, and it was kind of a, you know, the name was appropriately used because I was just kind of driven to want to make a completely solo album. I wanted to do everything myself. So there's 11 or 12 songs on the record. I wrote all of them except for one. And I played all the instruments. I engineered the album. I mixed the album. I edited the album. I did all the sequencing. I did everything on that album. The only thing I didn't do was master it, and Bob Ludwig mastered it.
And that
came out in 2014. Which was the same year that I got inducted into the Boston Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Excellent.
You lost
a long way. That's a long way from pumping gas and getting more squish.
Oh, but that's a good one.
So that's 2014, and then, you know, one of your main influences, you ended up essentially joining the band of Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page, which in 2015, the Yardbirds came calling, correct?
Yeah. What happened with that is, how that happened, and yes, you're right. I mean, Jeff Beck has been a touchstone for me since 1965 when I heard him in the Yardbirds. I've followed him, and he's probably the original guitar hero, and still probably the best rock guitar player that's ever picked up an instrument. And some of the best rock guitar players will say that their favorite was Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not alone in that thinking. But how that happened is that the Yardbirds had an album out on Favored Nations as well. And they came to town, trying to think, right around the same time as my second album. So it must have been around 2004. And they were playing the original House of Blues too. So I had a night off. I went to see them. They asked me to sit in, which I did. And it went famously well. And that was that. I met all the guys, nice guys. And then I got a call from Favored Nation's label a few days later that said that the Yardbirds were playing at B.B. King in New York. Would I go down and sit in again?
Oh, wow.
So they flew me down, and I ended up doing that. Then I got a call from them in 2014. So this is about 9 years later, and asked me if I would do a tour with them. And unfortunately, I had already a solo tour booked on my own, and I couldn't get out of the dates. They were right on top of the dates they were doing, and my tickets were already on sale. So I had a regretfully declined the tour. I couldn't do it. And then they had hired Earl Slick, from David Bowie's band, and played with John Lennon and a bunch of people. And that tour ended up getting canceled because Jim McCarty, the founding member, drummer of the Yardbirds, had a medical procedure that he could. So the tour got canceled. When they went to redo the tour in 2015, a year later, Earl Slick was out. He didn't want to do it, or something happened. They had a falling out. I don't know. And so I got a call again, and I was just putting another tour together, but I hadn't put tickets on sale yet. So I was able to do their tour, and which ended up being about 3 years of working with them. I think I did about 150 shows with them.
Wow. That's cool.
That's pretty crazy. So that was kind of like a bucket list thing, because, that being one of the two most influential bands from my youth, and Jeff Beck being my fave, and I actually had met Jeff Beck a few times because I had opened up for him at the State Theater in Portland, Maine in, I think, 2001. And then I had jammed with him when I was a counselor at Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. And then to actually play in the band and sit in his seat of a guy that you've idolized for that many, 50 years was quite an incredible, honor for me,
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. That was exactly right.
Corey. So after the Yardbirds thing kind of winds down, it kind of, dovetail, good or bad, with the whole COVID shutdown in 2020. And again, this is where I really kind of get back in touch with what you were up to, because you put on essentially a free 90-minute live stream concert, like every weekday on Facebook for like 3 years. It was like five days a week for quite a while. And I mean, that was just so cool because, of course, there were no shows back then. People are dying for entertainment, and here you are online offering essentially a free, pass the hack kind of thing. Look at what I'm doing. I'm still keeping busy. And man, oh man, some of those were just amazing to watch.
It was interesting. That was another thing that was a purely happenstance thing. I went on one day, and the reason I went on is I was having a problem with my insurance company, my car insurance company, and I was in a bitch mode, So I went on live, and I'm bitching. It's a bitch fest about the insurance company or something. I can't quite remember. And I had all of a sudden, you could see the viewers. It was like 200 people. So it was crazy. And that was it. It was going to be a one-off. That was it. I was just really voicing my frustration of what I was going through at the time. And my cousin, Sue, called me, who's 10 months younger than me, who actually went to see the Beatles and Hendrix with. She said, that was great. You should do that. You should do that more often. I said, that was stupid. I'm thinking this is stupid. And she said, no, you should do it. People really enjoyed it. You see all the comments on your page? I said, no, I didn't even check. Yeah. So I started to do it. And I would, some days would be a theme about we'd listen to music and break down a song, or I'd play tracks from my albums, like, et cetera. I ended up doing every morning, I think it was 10 a.m., for 90 minutes, 5 days a week. I think I did over 300 of them.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's a really
And it was no money, but I had my PayPal. I said, if you want to donate, that's great. I mean, I got one guy from Boulder, Colorado, sent me $1,000 one day.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
That's awesome.
That's really good.
And I ended up getting a 1099 from PayPal that year. I'm telling you, man, I have to thank my fans. They actually, that and the government stipend, that kept us alive that year.
Yeah, sure.
No, I remember just coming across at Happenstand. I remember sharing everyone you're on there. Like, check it out. He's live, and he's just doing his thing. It was awesome, and it sounded amazing. It really was. And again, there was nothing going on back then. You couldn't go see live music, so there was a really nice thing to fall back on. And it was, I'll just say thank you for doing that. That was a really And thanks to the other ones who said you should keep doing it, your sister. That was a really great idea, and it was big, big hit, I think. Went over really well.
Yeah, it was funny. It was kind of one of those weird things that just happens, you know?
So we're getting close to the end of the hour. I want to make sure we don't forget a couple things here. You're still gigging, obviously. We talked about this. You've got a couple different shows or a couple different tours you go out with, a couple different acts, I should say. One is Just Me and My Guitars. The other one is the Beck Ola, which celebrates Jeff Beck's music. And then you have a brand new one you just kind of started. Maybe you could introduce what the Johnny A. Syndicate's all about.
Yeah, the Syndicate is basically kind of a refresh of what I'm doing. It's my trio that has Marty Richards on drums and Dean Cassell on bass. But I've added a vocalist. And it's going back to kind of music that inspired me as a young guitarist. So it's a lot of the kind of more bluesy rock stuff, you know, things that I used to listen to, whether it be Savoy Brown or, you know, early Yardbirds or Cream, or it's not necessarily their songs, but it's in that ilk of the musicality. And it's a lot of fun for me because it's totally improv, you know, it's all off the cuff.
And that's great.
Whereas like when I do the Just Me and My Guitars things, which I've actually stopped doing because I was doing it for 6 years and I just kind of got burnt out on it. It was a very structured show because I was using loopers and everything was live, but it was to a loop and it had to be synced up. And so there wasn't a lot of freedom from the standpoint of musical freedom, like improv going on.
Right.
And the Beck Ola thing, you know, you're kind of not that we weren't playing things note for note, but you still need to exercise the kind of the vibe of what act you're trying to portray. So this thing, this Johnny A Syndicate, or even my Johnny A Trio, when I go out with that, it's a much freer thing for me. I have a lot of fun because, you know, I think I actually play at my best when I'm shooting from the hip, you know.
Sure.
That's good.
And that's what this thing is. It's like that. So, and I got a great support band behind me. And so I'm having a lot of fun with this. We are debuting that that brand, the Syndicate thing, I think June 19th, which is my wedding anniversary. We've got a show at the Bull Run.
Perfect.
There's also a really good show coming up at the end of May at the Blue Ocean, where I'm doing a co-headliner with Barry Gaudreau.
That's
May 29th, so that should be a good show.
Is that his engine room, I assume, that Benny's still doing that?
Yeah, it's the engine room and my trio. And I have a guest vocalist coming in on that. And it should be fun. Barry's an old friend. I've known him since the Streets days, actually. He's got a great band. You know, he's got a big band with, you know, three background singers and keyboards and very big, big sound.
Yeah, no, and they're great. They're putting a really good show. A lot of fun.
That's good.
So that should be fun.
Before we go, I've got one thing to ask you about. When you're traveling, you had a scene that was in Seattle when the equipment was lost. Now, I just want to let you know, my daughter works for Apple, and she worked on this thing called an iTag, and it's an AirTag, actually, it's called. And
yeah, I know. That was in my gear. I had
it. Did you find it with
it? I lost it. Oh, yeah. I knew where it was all along. I couldn't get the airlines to help me. Get the airlines to help me. I had an AirTag in my case.
Oh, excellent.
And it ended up not – I had basically a connection flight. I flew from Boston to LaGuardia to San Francisco.
Oh, so you got it. Excellent.
So the case ended up not getting transferred. It was sitting at LaGuardia, and I could see the air tag. I knew exactly – the case didn't move for 2 weeks. And I kept calling the airlines. Nobody would help me. Finally, how I got this back was I had a fan on Facebook. I don't even know who he is. He's just a fan. And he said, hey, man, I live near, I think it was Kennedy Airport, not LaGuardia. He said, I live near Kennedy. Do you want me to go over there and see if I can get your bag? And I said, well, you can. I said, but I doubt very much they're going to let you anywhere near baggage. You know, they're not going to let security. So he goes over there and he starts talking to the agent, and they don't want to know nothing. They don't want to help at all. And he calls me from there. Finally, he gets the agent at Babbage to call me. So she calls me. She's very nice, but she says, yeah, we can't send anybody. I said, look, I can tell you where this bag is. I can see it. As a matter of fact, if you've got somebody with an iPhone, I will forward my iTag information from and they can just walk and find it. Wow. She said, we can't do that. Finally, she calls me back again. She goes, okay, I got somebody that'll walk up the ramp. What is it? Can you send me a picture of what it looks like? And it's a Pelican case, a black Pelican case with red handles and red latches. And I said, it's got my name. It's got my business card right on the front of it. So sure enough, they send the guy up there. It's sitting exactly where I told him it was for 2 weeks.
I love it. Amazing. See, that's what I'm glad I brought that up, because that was my big thing with you when that equipment, I was going to write you on Facebook saying, you got to get that AirTag, but you already got it. And that's...
No, I have it in all my stuff. I got it in everything.
Excellent.
But here's the funny thing. When they get the case, I said, okay, can you please just ship it on the next flight to Logan? And I'll, you know, he said, no, we got to send it to San Francisco. I said, what are you talking about? Because that's where the original complaint was.
No.
I said, Just give it to that guy. Give it to my fan.
Oh my God.
We can't do that. I said, just give it to him. I said, I'll vouch for it. I won't hold you responsible. And I had a gig at Tupelo Music Hall the next night, and I needed that gear for that because it was my Jeff Beck show.
Yeah.
The guy gets the case, and he FedExes it to me overnight. It cost me $436 to get it back overnight.
Jesus.
Wow.
Well, yeah, down that area. That's awesome. What a good guy to do that for you.
Really?
Oh, God. Yeah, I was lucky. Yep.
What a nightmare. Very lucky. All right. On that note, I know I had to bring that up, though. We want to thank you for this interview and stuff, this talk. It's just really been good. I could go on for hours with you, but we have a time limit tonight. It's just there right now.
All right, my brothers. Well, thank you so much. And keep rocking and, keep healthy. And we'll see each other in the future.
Oh, yes. You keep at it. You've got a wonderful spirit. You've got a wonderful wife, wonderful kids that really, every level, just keep performing and playing and vibed. And with lots of love
to
you.
All right, guys.
Lots of
thank you, Johnny. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Johnny. All right. And this is three pints in a corner, closing out.
All right, talk soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.